This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join the Discord server for Sophomere Studios.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/sophiamarestudios, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we are covering Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, chapters 7 and 8, Bagman and Crouch, and the Quidditch World Cup. In these episodes, we get two very different approaches to leadership.
Ooh, interesting. Okay, I'm excited to know what you mean by that. This is very, in the previous books, we'd have been at Hogwarts by now, probably. And very interesting chapters so far in these chapters have been very interesting and very different.
Yeah. So. And then chapter 8, Victor Crumb catches the snitch splaying blood everywhere as he does so.
Very gross. The whole time I was reading that, I was like, I wonder what this looks like in the movie. I have no idea. So I'll find out at some point.
So chapter 7, Bagman and Crouch. So as you were saying, we're usually at Hogwarts at this time. How do you feel about the pacing of the fact that we're doing so much in the summertime?
It's so different. This is so much. I kind of like the background to, you know, a toe in the Muggle world, how things kind of work outside of Hogwarts, because it is just kind of almost like everyday life, but with magic. So it's interesting, but yet a little bit of me is like, where's Dumbledore already? So, but this, you know, I feel like this is definitely setting up something bigger. I mean, not just the I almost said Triwizard Tournament. I know about that, but the Quidditch World Cup, which obviously is a huge deal. I'm not British, so I can't make any comparison to I don't know what the football in the UK
is. The FIFA World Cup, whatever that is.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I'm sure that's like about at that level. So, I mean, I'm still here. I was actually surprised by the chapter 8 that I actually was engaged in most of it, you know, didn't glaze over with the Quidditch parts. But I don't know, as far as your reread goes and the kind of lack of, like, I don't know if this is setting this up for the rest of the books or this is just kind of a one-off thing.
I was thinking much more about the sort of emphasis of definitely, you know, obviously there are certain plot elements, but a good chunk of it is just trying to help the reader to understand the sheer scale of the magical world. And Harry's like, oh, I'm such a moron. Of course there have to be like other schools. And like, it's like, the United Kingdom isn't just on this one island in the world that happens to have wizards. Like, they're everywhere.
I appreciated that because I kind of felt like it is very, it is some world building that I didn't really think about either. It's like, well, I think I've even asked you a couple of times, like, well, you know, what about these other places and where the wizards are? So it just does kind of help reiterate how vast the wizarding world is. It's global, obviously, as we find out at the campsite and things like that.
Yeah, and it's also the idea that, as you said, at Hogwarts, they're just out in the boonies, in the Highland Moors, you know, doing whatever they want because they're in this isolated castle. But what are the real implications of people and their wizards in their everyday life you know, side by side, yet hidden from Muggles. What does that look like? And so the Quidditch World Cup is definitely a major example of all the hoops they have to go through to do what they want, but still maintain their secrecy.
Yeah, and it's interesting, and they kind of do explain that. I know that was something I asked about last time. I was like, what? How does this all work? So we do get some explanation in here.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we begin with they are trying to find their campsite, and the owner of the campsite is a Muggle.
Yeah, so he's an owner of the campsite, but he's not like privy to the wizarding world. They obliviate him, so he kind of stays that way, is my understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they do obliviate him like 10 times a day, like practically. And I'm just thinking, like, in terms of like, what are the potential damages to like with memory charms? Because on the one hand, and maybe it depends on how skilled the spellcaster is, but there's kind of this insinuation that on the one hand, they can be very harmless and right. innocent. And then you got the other side of the spectrum where Gilderoy Lockhart was prepared to not just wipe their memories, but completely destroy, basically get Harry and Ron to the point that they were in a vegetated state. So the dangers of memory charms, it has probably both based on the skill level of the caster and what the intent of the caster is.
That just makes me think of, I think I talked about this last year all the time, What We Do in the Shadows. Now it's back on again on FX, which is a vampire show. I'm sure most people have heard of it. But it's kind of, they do a memory charm in the first season, and then kind of it has the same reaction where somebody just is kind of has no brains left. But then the familiar on the show is like, yeah, they've done this to me so often, I just kind of have built resistance to it. So like, I don't, it's like, yeah, sure, you like wipe my memory, or maybe it's the hypnosis. Either way, I kind of worried about this guy too. I was like, is Mr. Roberts just going to be totally like zonked out, or, you know, does it get to a point where he's like, I know y'all are wizards, it's whatever.
Yeah, like, because they try to portray it very innocently that the worst thing that could happen to him is just like maybe just kind of having a sensation similar to being hungover.
Yeah, well, it's not too bad. We've all dealt with the hangover, maybe.
Yeah, and again, Arthur, it's kind of distressing to me how inept Arthur is with Muggle stuff, even though he has a passion for it and does it a good deal with Muggles, a great deal, and Muggle artifacts in his job. So what does it say that even someone whose specialty is like Muggle stuff is so inept? What does that say about the normal wizard, or even like, again, like the pure blood wizard that doesn't know crap and doesn't care to know crap about the Muggles?
That confused me as well when he's like trying to pay and he's like, Harry, help me out, you know, help me with this money. I kind of thought that as well. I'm like, well, what is going on? I wonder if it's just the big flashy stuff he's interested. I don't what apparently a toaster or whatever is big and flashy in the Muggle world, but you know, that he doesn't pay attention to the little quote unquote trivial things. That was kind of interesting to me as well.
Yeah. Instantly, Mr. Roberts' eyes slid out of focus. His brows unknitted, and a look of dreamy unconcern fell over his face. Like, it basically sounds like he's high.
Yeah. whatever it takes, I guess. That's all good. That's funny.
Yeah. So then they start meandering over to their specific campsite. But even Ginny is like, I thought Mr. Bagman was head of magical games and sports, said Ginny. He should know better than to talk about bludgers near Muggles, shouldn't he? So what does that say about, like, Bagman? Like, I've never thought about this in detail before, but Ginny is 13, and even she cares more about Muggle security than these, like, heads of department.
That kind of reminds me, like, to apply it to real life. Sometimes I have heard stories of people in kind of lofty positions gossiping about staff. And I'm like, thought y'all were supposed to be better than that. And then it's just so, I guess this is might be a situation of everybody kind of makes mistakes. I was going to say is human, but that doesn't apply. So I don't know. It is, it is, it, it is interesting. Or maybe they're just like hyper aware. I feel like Jenny's getting a little bit of that, like, you know, kind of having been around Hermione is kind of looking to, for the errors or something.
And what is it? And it says Ludo didn't like climb and sort of bureaucratically, like he got into the Department of Magical Games and Sports because he was a Quidditch player.
Yeah. And this was interesting.
So it's just interesting about those like head, those sort of executive head positions where it's less about, you know, quote unquote, doing work as it is it was schmoozing with other people and being able to build relations. And so,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, I just think this is just another example of the real world kind of spilling over into the muggle world and how sometimes people get these positions, not because they have like the most knowledge or background. It's just because they're like, yeah, let's put a Quidditch player in here. He was great. Whatever.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of an article that I sometimes see popping around in my newsfeed or other places. I don't think I read it fully, but the thesis of it was that, you know, with the pandemic and doing remote work, again, remote work, you know, you can tell of its usefulness by it now judges people by sheer productivity.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and now, and, you know, in a way that is best for people like, again, who do have a lot of merits and qualifications and get the job done. And it's really bad for people like in these sort of executive positions where it's now shining a light on the fact that they're not contributing a great deal to the company.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I guess depending on where you fall in that, you know, it has that done any, I think that some of those people are the ones that kind of are doing the ass kissing, for lack of a better term, or all that performative stuff are the ones that, you know, extroversion excluded, are kind of really excited to get back into these social settings. So they can kind of, they're like, this is what I was doing, this is what I was building, instead of just kind of, like you said, being productive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, well, again, ass kissing is necessary to a certain degree, but again, not to the point that, you know, you diminish what everyone else does. And
right. Yeah.
Okay. Karl Marx was right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So as they're going through the campsite, at first the tents look quasi-normal. Then you get a tent with a chimney on it.
Yes. And they, as they're kind of like putting their tent together, Harry's kind of like, you know, because they're trying to keep, I think this is an important thing to remember in this whole situation. They're trying to keep up this appearance that they're just muggles going camping. And, you know, to the, from the outside looking in, and Harry has some concern about like, well, this tent is a little small. Oh, and then he walks in and it's quite, it smells like cats, but then he makes a throwback to the, person that he was kind of dumped on when the Dursleys would go out of town.
Mrs. Fig. Yeah, no, it's, yeah, like the tent itself is about the size of a, you know, small apartment.
Yeah.
And, you know, but even on the outside, their tents look normal. Like the others, they can't even contain it within like the interior of the tent. Like they're like, again, with chimneys and then several live peacocks tethered at the entrance. A little farther on, they passed a tent that had three floors and several turrets. And a short way beyond, there was a tent that had a front garden attached, complete with bird bath, sundial, and fountain.
I've done a lot of camping in my childhood, and that would raise an alarm if I saw that. So
I was, one question I had in my notes. So if you had to devise your perfect magical tent, what amenities would it have?
Man. I mean, it would obviously have, like, I guess, again, since I was talking about camping, just the idea that the inside would have like a bathroom and a shower, like perfect. Cause going camping, that was just not going to happen. What like other stuff would I like? Probably a library, an office, you know, just something like that. Just some place to go and think. Maybe if I wanted to get real fancy with it, like a, oh man, those really rich people that have the like little home theater setting. That would be my, th- those would be my choices. What about you?
Yes. Well, of course, in addition to the general, the concept that it can expand and is basically the size of an apartment, I'd want, again, all of those typical amenities in an apartment, a library, a soft serve ice cream machine.
Oh, yum. That's good.
And in terms on the outside that I, again, like these people, I would want a big ass sundial like these other people and also an astrolabe for me to do all my celestial witchy things.
I like that. It's a new moon today too.
Yes. Yeah. That's why I'm kind of attributing that to the part that I'm so zen today.
That's good.
Starting new things, a new cycle. Yes. Everything in the past is gone.
Let's get that new moon in Virgo, right? So it's like,
oh, I forget which sign it is, but Virgo is a good one for me to do some manifesting for career steps. So down to earth, analytical, all good things.
I need to do that tonight too. So,
So they create. So yeah, there's a tent for the boys, tents for the girls, and they eventually send Harry, Ron, and Hermione over to get some water.
Which this is a very clever way for them to kind of peep into all the other tents and all the other, you know, wizards and witches who are out in the world that they may not have encountered. Specifically, Harry has not really seen.
Yes, he saw a little boy poking his dad's wand at a slug.
This was gross.
Yes. What is it with Harry the writer and slugs? Like,
I don't know. Like, he must really not like them.
Like, did Dudley play a prank on Harry, like, before the series started, like, as a child, where now he's got traumatized by slugs?
That's what we need. We need, like, the pre-Harry, you know, pre-Hogwarts times Harry Potter, like, the pre... I think that's out there. I don't know.
I'm sure there's plenty of fanfics out there.
Yes. Yeah, we got the little people riding the broomsticks, but kind of like not too far in the air, but far enough for it to raise some alarm.
And then we've got some American witches, where the Salem Witches Institute. Yeah. And we eventually get bombarded by all the Irish supporters.
Yeah, so the very obvious thing with their kind of area is everything is covered in shamrocks and green. And I bet that's pretty visually interesting. But they're playing in the Quidditch World Cup. So yeah, they've got all their support out.
It's just interesting. I'm surprised that the word shamrock made it into the American edition of Harry Potter, because I don't think I've ever heard a person call... I know what it is, but I always... think of it as a clover or a three-leaf clover, and then the four-leaf clover, you know, is the one where it's lucky.
Okay. I didn't know that. I mean, the word shamrock didn't, I guess, surprise me in here, but interesting. Yeah.
At least where I came from, like, shamrock was not a thing.
Okay. I had a good friend who was Irish. Maybe that's the only reason. When I was a kid, that's the only reason.
Yeah, so they bump into Seamus Finnegan, their buddy in Gryffindor. And, you know, just thinking about, again, all the Irish are congregated here, it really made me think about, because, again, we all have those weird quirks that we're interested in. Like, I'm not the biggest history buff, but there are a few points in history that I find quite fascinating. The Titanic is one of them. I think I might have died on the Titanic in a past life. The War of the Roses, naturally, to better understand Game of Thrones. But another... Yeah. Big part of European history that I do like to read about and watch drama shows about is the conflict of the English and the Irish.
Oh, okay. I didn't
and
know
so
that.
I'm just all so this just got me thinking in terms of, we only hear of one Ministry of Magic, and we're to infer that that is the equivalent of, you know, the UK's government, but the United Kingdom does not include Ireland, but does it in the Wizarding World. So it just made me think of how much does the Muggle politics with the Anglo-Irish stuff bleed into Wizarding stuff. Because as far as we see, it seems they get along pretty well, and the Irish kids go to Hogwarts the same as the Northern Irish, the Welsh, the Scottish, and the English.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. I was watching something. It made me think of English, Irish. I am not like that well versed in history, but the Titanic thing, I have had the same thought about myself. So I wonder where we were. I'm interested in that as well. I kind of thought about, I know that there's some tension, and I feel like I've watched enough British shows that they always make little digs at Irish people, but this seemed to go along pretty smoothly, to the point where, you know, Ron and Harry, that's the team that they're going to be cheering for, with the exception of Victor Crumb, which they're like psyched about him just because he's a good, you know, player.
Yes, he is a very good player. And yeah, Crumb. Interesting. I'm curious about the last name Crumb, because I actually had a Turkish professor. I never had her for Turkish, but I worked with her when I was part of the Turkish flagship program, and her last name was Crumb, but it wasn't her like maiden name. It was her like married name. So I think maybe she married like an Eastern European guy or of descent of that. Cause yeah, I'm like, just like thinking again, I'm like, yeah, I actually do know a Crumb in real life.
That's interesting. Yeah. That name is funny. And I just kind of wondered about it. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. And Hermione's like, he looks really grumpy.
Hermione. Okay. So as like, I'm like, okay, this is like true confessions. I feel like I kind of know where the Hermione Victor Crumb, there's going to be a connection down the line, I think.
Right. So how does that make you? Yeah. So how does that make you feel in terms of, you know, just her looking on Victor Crumb as a celebrity?
It reminds me of Benedict Cumberbatch. Sorry, everybody. This probably makes you laugh. But the first time I saw Benedict Cumberbatch, I was like, that guy's kind of interesting looking, to be nice. And then I had like the biggest crush on Benedict Cumberbatch. He's still fine, like whatever. But that kind of reminds me, Hermione reminded me of myself there. It's like, oh, this guy is like a grumpy jerk looking. And then it's kind of like, eh, and then you kind of get over that. And, yeah,
and
she's
then you
like
realize
all about him.
And then you realize Benedict Cumberbatch is a genius.
Exactly. And he
who can do everything from Doctor Strange, Sherlock Holmes, to the dragon Smaug.
I am, like I said, I was like super into him. And now I still appreciate him. He's a fantastic actor. Patrick Melrose, if you want to watch a series to be very upset, that is one to watch. So anyway, so that's how I kind of thought. I was like, oh, Hermione, I see you. I see you.
And right after this, this always stuck out to me as one of like the most hilarious moments in the series, as just a throwaway piece of comedy, Archie in his nightgown.
Yes, I appreciated that as well. What does he say?
I bought this in a muggle shop, said the old wizard stubbornly. Muggles wear them. Muggle women wear them, Archie, not the men. They wear these, said the ministry wizard, and he brandished the pinstripe trousers. I'm not putting them on. I like a healthy breeze round my privates. Thanks.
And then Hermione heard that and found that quite amusing. I like it. It is something that it's like, oh, if you were just glossing over it, you would have missed it. But that was pretty cute.
Yes. And yet to not be a Debbie Downer in terms of she who must not be named, the ghost writer and her crap.
I was thinking that. Just as we thought about that, there's a little bit of shamey here, and I don't appreciate that. I appreciate the giggle that Hermione had, but at the time that this, I guess the culture and the climate that it was written in, and now, like...
Yeah, the early 90s, like, I think it's still comedic in the sense that, you know, Archie isn't doing it based on any notion of gender fluidity or gender identity. Like, no. It's just the, I don't, you know, like most of the wizards around here, he just doesn't know what the hell he's doing in terms of muggle attire.
Right. And I guess, you know, in a little bit of, I didn't take it as the, like, a man wearing a dress was funny. I took it as like, you know, they're saying like, maybe don't do that, you know, at this point in time, whatever. He's just like, just wanting to keep it out in the breeze, like whatever, maybe wear a kilt. That's usually something that's not, you know, mm-hmm. I don't know, but.
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, but if he had said, but the flowers are so pretty, I want it. Like if he was making like something very, very specific about it, then that would be one thing. But again, I think it's just supposed to be the comedic of wizards don't know what the hell they're doing right now.
Right. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yep. And so they run into Oliver Wood, Ernie McMillan, and Cho Chang.
Oh, Cho Chang. All about her here in a while.
And run in some other school-age children, but probably go to foreign schools.
Yeah, and I think this is where, you know, it was Harry laughed but didn't voice the amazement he felt at hearing about other wizarding schools. He supposed now that he saw representatives of so many nationalities in the campsite that he had been stupid never to realize that Hogwarts couldn't be the only one. And I feel like Harry needs to be a little less hard on himself here because he was not privy to the fact there was a wizarding world until like 3 years ago.
Yeah. So. And in the 3 years that he's been part of this world, he's been battling an evil, dark wizard, unable to expand his knowledge, like, to the point that he typically would if he wasn't being bogged down by Voldemort, Tom Riddle, Peter Pettigrew. Right.
It's like, yeah, I don't know why I'm going to equate this, but it's like living through a pandemic. It's like, we're living through this. We've got enough things to like think about just in our daily life. And if you're a person riddled with anxieties, like I am, like that's enough. And then it's always this like, oh yeah, but Voldemort. Oh yeah, of course I didn't think about this because I'm trying to live. So anyway, I'm going to cut Harry some slack with his lack of knowledge here.
Yep. Because if Delta wasn't enough, now the Mu variant has entered LA.
God almighty. I said to a friend, when we look at each other in 10 years, when we're in a field with machetes, we'll be like, we made the right decision. So.
Oh, dear. And then one thing I noticed was Ron makes the comment, I know there are others. Never met anyone who went to one, though. Bill had a pen friend at a school in Brazil. This was years and years ago. And he wanted to go on an exchange trip, but mom and dad couldn't afford it. His pen friend got all offended when he said he wasn't going and sent him a cursed hat. It made his ears shrivel up. So just for me, as someone who works in the study abroad field, I definitely felt that one. Because there is the notion that a lot of times I think of the study abroad experience, like that semester in your junior or senior year, it's very much reminiscent of an old school grand tour of Europe that rich white guys used to do. And so there is this sense that, yeah, it's good to go abroad to like expand your horizons and find yourself while you're abroad and, you know, things like that. But again, it's study abroad is so, again, costs money and there are questions of equality and equity and, you know, I feel like only in the last 2 years have people really started to get with the program trying to address how do we get, you know, people of color or more women and like other, you know, LGBTQ plus students, how do we get them going abroad too?
Have you, that is very interesting because I think about the people that I knew abroad. I went to high school that had several exchange students, which, you know, I personally didn't know anybody. And granted, it's probably because where I grew up and it wasn't a very affluent community, but we did have people come from, I think, mainly South Korea to our high school. The question, I guess, since you have insight into that world, has something like that ever happened? Has somebody ever developed a relationship, like or a friendship, and then been offended because the other party couldn't like afford to come over? I feel like that's a very, I don't know if that's something lost in translation or if that's just lost in youth, you know?
I've never been at the level because I've never done like directly exchange as I've done more so just Americans going abroad. So I can't say I came across a situation like that. But yeah, which is one thing why I really like the programs, the last program and the current program I work for, is because it's tied to a critical language and the Department of Defense is desperate for people to know those languages. They're willing to put their money where their mouth is. So we can advertise for scholarships in a way that just normal study abroad programs, not that there aren't other scholarships and stuff, but because our study abroad is tied to a critical language, there's money for it. There's much more money and opportunity for it for people to get the money to offset those study abroad costs.
Okay. Interesting.
So, yeah. And again, just sad that the poor kid, again, just in folly of youth, not being able to see that it's not a lack of will, right. It's a lack of finances, which always sucks.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's hard to understand that as a kid. Definitely is. So I think that you know, as they're kind of continuing on with that, they're struggling with the, you know, Mr. Weasley's trying to light some matches to build a fire, to make some food, which again, how does he not know how to do these things, even that given his obsession with muggles? And then I think the rest of the family kind of shows up finally while they're trying to make dinner. Yeah, whatever they're making.
Yeah, they show up, and then we get a few just also notions, insights into the Ministry of Magic. It's like, here comes Gilbert Wimple. He's with the Committee on Experimental Charms. He's had those horns for a while now. it makes me think of the Satanic God.
I was just looking at some goats today, so that's what came to mind.
Although speaking of the Satanic stuff, like literally. The Satanists in Texas are trying to get a religious exemption from the abortion ban.
Oh, okay. Which,
again, more power to you for if you can make that loophole work. I'm down for that.
I love those Satanists. They're very interesting. I like what they do. It's usually political.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And then we've got, you know, Arnold Peacegood, an Obliviator. And Bode and Kroger, they're unspeakables. They're what? From the Department of Mysteries. Top secret. No idea what they get up to.
Now that's the department I think I want to work in. That would be fun. I need to know about that.
So. Yes. So, and then, yeah, Bill Char Percy come around. And then finally, Ludo Bagman shows up. What were your impressions of our dear Ludo?
Okay, Ludo, I'm trying to look at him again. So this is the guy that kind of has like the childish face, but he kind of looks like he was probably somebody, I don't know, for lack of a better term, jacked back in the day, but kind of is like a belly now. And
beer belly. Like, honestly, yeah. His description reminds me of Robert Baratheon. In the Game of Thrones, because they described the same way, a guy that was really jacked and handsome and now has let himself go.
Okay, yeah, that's the visual that I kind of had when I was thinking about this was Lockhart, but like let himself go too. So I don't know why, just the childish face in my mind, which I know he's supposed to be very handsome, but I was thinking of the actor instead anyway. I kind of spiraled out there, but he seemed... fine. I didn't, you know, I guess he didn't make too much of an impression on me. Crouch made more of an impression on me, but I think that's because of the reaction, Barty Crouch, that people had. So Ludo Bagman, based on your question, I feel like he's going to be more important and I probably overlooked it. Oh, so
dang it. Dang it. I need to be more subtle.
No. I don't know. Right now, he was a little forgettable for me, but now I know to pay attention.
Well, half of the chapter is named after him, so.
Well, and that was kind of part of my, like, okay, I know he's significant, but I don't understand his significance quite yet.
And he likes to gamble.
Yes, that was his significance at the end of the, anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. But yes, he takes it up on the Weasleys, which... I found a little problematic. I was a little annoyed with him here because it is no secret that the Weasleys are not a wealthy family. And he kind of is like, let's gamble. I just didn't like that very much.
Mm-hmm. Not just Arthur, like gambling with the underage boys.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that, I guess that's legal in the wizarding world. Nobody seemed to have a problem with it. So.
Yep. And then we get... I think they make Bagman a cup of tea, and he's talking about Crouch, and he's like, oh, I need Crouch. My Bulgarian opposite is making matters difficult. I can't understand a word he's saying. And Percy's like, Mr. Crouch, he speaks over 200 languages, Mirmish and Gobbledygook and Troll. So I'm just, as a linguistic nerd, I'm just curious, like, is there like magic to help you learn languages at a higher rate? Or is there a charm that can help you like directly translate things? Like, I'm curious I don't think there's anything to suggest that you can just have a spell or drink a potion that magically makes you like omnilingual, like makes you understand a language immediately. But I wonder what tools they have at their disposal.
I'm really glad you pointed that out, because I kind of thought, you know, okay, this guy knows a bunch of languages, but wouldn't it be easy to, I don't know, like do a pre-Google, you know, translate in the wizarding world for this? So I appreciate that that's a skill that somebody, or, you know, something that somebody can have in 200 and, or what is it, like 200 languages? That's a lot to know. So I had that same question. I also, they said anybody can speak troll, which all you have to do is point and grunt. I don't know if that's true or not, but there's another mention of
points,
and Dorkins.
Oh, points sorry. Against Fred and George for bashing neurodiversity.
Is that what that is, with the trolls? Or
Well, just the or? Idea of, you know, trolls are thought to be really stupid.
Okay. Yeah,
I've heard the term neurodiversity, you know, in terms of questions of like eugenics, whether like people with Down syndrome, should they be having children, and people like particularly family members trying to bar them from having children and things like that.
Okay. I remember the one troll that we've encountered was early on, but
the big one, you know, that they fight, and Hermione did not die, unlike some people's morbid imaginations.
Yes.
And then we only saw trolls again when they hired a few security trolls to protect the fat lady when she came back to guard the tower.
Okay. I didn't know a bunch of troll.
Yeah, but yes, Bertha Jorkins is mentioned again. And I'm just curious, I don't have an answer, but I was just thinking in my notes I have, the dismissal of Bertha, is it rooted in sexism? Would they be as flippant if a man went missing?
Well, I'm thinking about comparatively based on the previous books, the only person that we really had go missing was a criminal that we kind of understand. So I can't really make that comparison right now. Maybe. I don't know if, you know, Bertha's like prevalence or predominance in the wizarding community. I don't know. I kind of have a feeling that you, let me put it this way. There have not been a lot of women in this series so far that have had a lot of like clout or importance. I think about Trelawney and how they kind of constantly mock her profession in a way. And we're kind of Gilderoy Lockhart gets to be performative and they kind of let it go. So sexism in the wizarding world, I think you might, you know, have a fair point. They might have more, it might be more taken more seriously if this were Barty.
Because we don't know enough about Bertha, just the fact that she was, that she, Peter Pettigrew absconded with her and she ended up dead because of Voldemort. The question is like she's portrayed as being like really, there's the question of, is Bertha and the dismissal they have, like, is that rooted? Does she have a rep? Is it purely, are they purely basing the sort of dismissal and not really want to deal with it? Are they basing it genuinely on her personality, that she is a sort of problematic worker and she like she's made problems and maybe she's not good at her job? Or are they just assuming that because that's the stereotype of like the foolish, like simpleton secretary?
Maybe. I mean, that she seems easily dismissed, whereas some other folks have not been. And it's like she'll just wander back into the office. It's no big deal. It's like that kind of sucks to treat somebody like that. But yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and then Crouch arrives on the scene. Total opposite of Bagman, dressed so immaculately in like a 3-piece suit that even Uncle Vernon wouldn't be able to distinguish him as a wizard.
Right. And Percy seems to be like very enamored with him, because I guess it's kind of like he's kind of emblematic of what Percy kind of strives to be. He really wants to impress him, make some tea for him.
And Crouch doesn't even know his real name.
Right. He calls him Weatherby, right?
Yep.
Or something like that. That's awful. That's awful.
And it must say something like how insignificant Crouch considers Percy, because again, the Weasley is a, like, he knows Arthur. Like he can't put it together. Oh, redheaded kid, like with W,
right.
Must be a Weasley.
Right. And why would he call him Weatherby?
Not to be discriminatory, that to say all Scots or all redheaded Irish people like look the same.
No. In the Weasley family, they do all have red hair. So yeah. I don't know. And I just, when they describe Mr. Crouch, I kept thinking of David Tennant, but I realized that's Barty Crouch Jr. So,
oh, yes.
I'm, because I was like, this guy doesn't, I've never seen Tennant with a mustache, but, okay. So this guy is very kind of.
Yeah. David Tennant is the voice of Henry VI in the Shakespeare play I'm listening to on audiobook.
Oh, nice. He's the best. He really is the best.
Better than Benedict Cumberbatch?
different categories. Different categories.
Apple oranges.
Yes, exactly. Pretty much, yeah. Tennant's a totally different guy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so this interaction is pretty, I don't know, it's just kind of seems very prim and proper and awkward a little bit, because we have this kind of like, we know the Weasleys are giggling that Percy's really trying to put on airs for Mr. Crouch, and they're just kind of like laughing at him behind his back. So
yeah, and I think it makes sense that Crouch is this very prim and very like traditional way, because he in essence is the State Department. He is the head of the Department of International Magical Relations, or International Magical Cooperation.
So he has to deal with a lot of different like people from different lands, and just kind of make sure everything and they're well represented. So that makes sense, because he's kind of essentially like the Bulgarian translator, right? Or the helper for Bagman to kind of understand what he's saying, right?
Yeah, because it's because this whole event is a combination of sports and international community.
Right, right.
And so they eventually, you know, both Crouch and Bagman leave, and they do a little bit of souvenir shopping.
They do, and I think before we get that, there's this little teaser that I did not go unnoticed. Something is going to be happening at Hogwarts that piques everybody's interest, but we don't get any more information from that. And then they go souvenir shopping, and Ron, probably like I would, gets excited and buys a bunch of stuff and then runs out of money at the event.
Yep. He buys a little like walking action figure of Victor Krum.
Yeah. Interesting.
Super boy crush.
yeah. They're all
hero worship of Victor Krum. And they get omnioculars. And Harry is nice and buys 3 pairs so that they can all have them.
That was very nice of Harry, being a good friend.
Yep. And then they go back, join their group, and it's already time for the Quidditch World Cup.
Dun, dun, dun. Big stuff coming
so,
up.
So, yeah, Quidditch World Cup. You said you weren't too bored by it, so, you know, why was that?
I honestly think because of the sirens, who I knew I would call the wrong thing. They are called, what does it start with? A V. I wrote
the Vila.
The Vila, yeah. I thought they were cool. That was my entertainment. And the leprechauns were pretty cool too. So,
So the stadium they created seats 100,000.
It's a lot of wizards.
And it's just interesting, the notion that they can create this whole stadium, you know, and probably just have it vanish, or, you know, disintegrate it magically in some way, shape, or form. Just got me thinking about, again, there's lots of questions about the ethics of the Olympics in terms of, you know, the sort of human rights, labor abuses and things of various countries who, you know, as they're prepping for it, and like just all the money that developing countries blow on the Olympics to put on a good show, but do they do it for the genuine development of their country, and all so many other things are still suffering so much? No.
Yeah. And I think it's always a little bit upsetting to see what happens with those event spaces, because sometimes they just kind of fall apart. I think, I don't remember who, one country like reused it for another purpose, but oftentimes they just kind of go to hell. Really.
Yeah. They get abandoned and all sorts of things. But, you know, we got a magical stadium. prime seats. And then just, again, Harry, as they're getting filing into the top box, you know, Harry's looking across the field, and on top of this blackboard is like various advertisements. And I'm just wondering, how many galleons does it cost to get an ad at the Quidditch World Cup?
Whatever galleon translate to like a Super Bowl ad, I bet that would be like an equivalent probably. So I liked this. I liked the ads. I thought that was really cute. And I was a little confused. I was like, okay, Wizards don't have it completely easy. You know, they have like mess remover. They have some things like that. So I had some questions about the products they were presented with. Like, is that just because some wizards are better at potions than others? I don't know.
Yeah. And then, so Harry is, you know, kind of situating himself, and he sees a non-human creature. He sees like these scrawny legs with big bat-like ears, and he's immediately like, Dobby!
And it is not Dobby.
No, it's a girl house elf named Winky.
Winky, I believe she belongs to the same family, though. It was basically a Dobby. Dobby got the boot. And this was kind of interesting. And the exchange between the Golden Trio and Winky, because basically Winky was kind of like, yeah, you didn't do the right thing. You shouldn't have freed Dobby. House elves are here to serve. It's like, oh, okay. Mm.
Yes, this will go on to be a big point in terms of, you know, the themes with the house elves, in terms of like white savior complex, where you're like trying to do good without directly like asking what the disadvantaged group wants, or can you accept what they want because they've been brainwashed to the point.
Okay.
So all of those things, like, I know a lot of people like, you know, feel different things about it every time they go through the Harry Potter series, because the whole situation with house elves is so complex.
I know that eventually there's a thing called Spew that Hermione starts, and I felt like this might be the kind of beginnings of those things. But I thought it was an interesting conversation, because I know Harry definitely felt really good about what he was doing, and I think that you're kind of the reader has tried to kind of made to feel like, oh, he did the right thing. He freed Dobby. So mm-hmm. I will be interested to see how that gets more complex.
Yeah. And she says, I says to Dobby, go find yourself a nice family and settle down. And I'm like, if women don't hear that all the time.
Yeah, no shit. Just get over yourself and just accept what you have. No, thank you.
And so that's a house elf, Ron muttered. Weird things, aren't they? Dobby was weirder.
I'm glad they addressed this, because I forgot that Ron and Hermione never met Dobby.
No, they never met Dobby, because Dobby only appeared privately to Harry.
That surprised me, and I think that maybe that's probably why he brought it back up to remind the reader that that's... Yeah, they never met him, so interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they gradually fill in, and of course they're in the top box again. Arthur and his company are only there because Ludo gave him fancy tickets, because Arthur smoothed over some shit Ludo's brother got into.
Yeah, well, and of course, you know, as everybody's kind of being nice and, you know, saying hi to each other, of course, the frickin' Malfoys show up and remind the Weasleys where exactly they should be. So mm-hmm. that was a wonderful, annoying thing.
Yeah, before the Malfoys show up, you know, we got the Bulgarian Minister of Magic, and Fudge is trying to convey to him, oh, this is Harry Potter. And then the minister goes off in Bulgarian when he sees Harry's scar, and Fudge is like, no, we get there eventually. And it just made me think of how famous Harry is in the world, because it's very much conveyed, like, when Voldemort was wreaking havoc in the 70s, it was very much restricted to the United Kingdom. Like, he wasn't, or at least wasn't yet, going like, world domination!
Right.
So other countries were not directly impacted by Voldemort, but it's just interesting, the notion of, like, Bulgaria, like, you know, is a stone's throw away from Istanbul, And yet, and yet they know who Harry Potter is.
Yeah, I think that's a, I'm glad you pointed that out, because that is something, again, kind of like Harry in the, you know, the tents, not realizing that there are more wizards in the world than just, you know, just, the UK.
I'm sorry, okay. I'm kicking Bacon out because he cannot be quiet.
He's fine.
Yep, and the Malfoys show up. And again, like, Arthur is there because of, you know, helping Ludo's brother. Malfoy is there because he just donated to the hospital. Neither of them should be there.
No.
Following normal bureaucratic stuff in the Ministry of Magic. Neither of them should be there.
Right, right. I wonder how that worked out now that, like, I mean, I don't know if how the Malfoys versus the Weasleys, if that's, I mean, I know they got in a full-on fight in the bookstore, which they remind us of that, but I didn't know if maybe it was a competitive thing. So he's like, oh, I'm going to donate money and I'm going to be here too, like, or if it was just whatever.
Yeah, it's just interesting, the notion of Arthur, I think here, because again, his connections with Ludo, his connections with the Flu Network people to, you know, get pick up Harry at the Dursleys, it's very much showing that for as low as he is paid, Arthur has social capital. It may be restricted to the ministry, but the ministry is the government. So, like,
right.
So it's interesting, the notion that, you know, he can pull all these favors, you know, in terms of, you know, helping people get out of their enchanted muggle crap shit. And then, and that seems to have, you know, they both got in the top box. That seems to have just as much weight as the fact that Lucius threw a lot of money at the hospital.
Right. Yeah. That's an interesting point. I didn't think about his, you know, Arthur's social capital and the versus the just capital, I guess. But interesting.
And we meet Draco's mother.
Yeah, which made me think of the actress who just passed away, right?
Actress. Yeah, she was actually supposed to play another character in Harry Potter, but she was pregnant at the time. So after she gave birth, and like, she still wanted to be a part of, you know, the franchise, and so they gave her the part of Narcissa.
Hmm. She's cool. I mean, she looks cool. They're kind of an interesting looking group, but she doesn't really say too much. She's just kind of there and, you know, whatever, really. Yeah.
And so
at this point.
And then ultimately, well, first, what'd you think of Vila and leprechauns?
I thought the Vila were very cool. They remind me of sirens, like mermaids or whatever. That's kind of what they're supposed to be, which I love how there are all the, you know, Harry and Ron are just totally enamored with them. And I don't know.
I don't know if Vila is the exact term, but they are rooted in not just like reinventing like Greek sirens. Like, there is an Eastern European sort of siren-esque figure, and it starts with a V. I don't know if it's exactly the term Vila, but something close to me, I think.
Okay. Interesting. Excuse me. I don't know. I think they're cool. I think sirens are cool, but I just like that power. And the leprechauns, I mean, that was pretty on brand, I guess, for Ireland. I thought it was nice that they, you know, kind of shot money in the air and everybody got to keep it. That's nice.
Yeah, that's it's good. And then the Bulgarian team comes out. Dimitrov, Ivanova. I actually have met an Ivanova in it was a Russian girl studying in Istanbul with me. So it's just interesting. I'm like, yeah, like, now I'm an adult coming back to this. And it's like, I have met people with these names.
That's cool. I have not, but yeah, that is cool. I like that they had that. And then they talk about Victor Crumb, who everybody's excited about.
Yep.
And an overgrown bird of prey.
Yep. And then the Irish come on, and here, and then the referee is Egyptian, which Hassan Mustafa. Oh, and then lots of mentions of Arabs in these two chapters, because we've got Hassan Mustafa, who is the referee. But even before that, Crouch was talking to Arthur like, Ali Bashar is on the warpath. He wants magic carpets to be legal.
Yeah, that whole thing, because then it could transport more people. But I don't know, that kind of confused me a little bit too. But the brooms are okay. The
like, how are brooms okay and not like, you know, brooms are a muggle item too. But yeah, I think it's a little bit of Orientalist prejudice that's barring magic carpets. But
I think I found my gothic theme finally. So,
and then do we need to go into the whole like commentary of the match?
No, we would be here for a while. It is a Quidditch match. It's of course a little bit more intense, and the stakes are higher, and it's obviously the best, most fun Quidditch match because it is the Quidditch World Cup. So,
mm-hmm. The only thing I have to say about the Quidditch World Cup is the idea of, like, in the middle of it, when the Veel are getting, like, agitated or something, like, Hassan Mustafa has landed right in front of the Veel and is clearly being charmed, like, you know, seduced, taken in by them. And that just made me feel a certain way because I have been to Egypt, and the unfortunate reality that Egypt always ranks the worst within Arab countries as being for sexual harassment.
Oh, okay.
And so It just kind of made me feel iffy because I don't know what specific... Well, I think I do know. So basically, Egypt in the 60s and 70s was super liberal, like women in miniskirts, very much like Iran in the 60s and 70s, like on the progressive modernizing train. And then there's a very conservative branch of Islam called Wahhabism that developed in Saudi Arabia. And basically Saudi Arabia, you know, poured a lot of money into Egypt to get this stuff going. And so over the last few decades, Egypt has gotten so conservative. Mm-hmm. And naturally, there's correlation with getting more conservative and having certain, you know, views of women. So what's very different about Egypt compared to other Arab countries is just how young boys start to harass women.
Oh, wow.
Like as young as 10 years old. It's really disconcerting because even in Jordan, when I was in that part of the Arab world, like because I'm white, they automatically presume I'm a Russian prostitute. But they
asked, oh my god!
But at least they were still men,
right?
Like, they were kids. Men. They were not little boys. And so, in terms of the pure objectification, I don't know what specifically with Egypt. So just seeing how it seems that an Egyptian who's much more easily swayed by the Veel, it made me feel a certain way.
That's interesting. Okay. I didn't know that context. And so this just makes me think of back in some, you know, theory. And granted, we were coming at it more of a Western perspective as like using sexuality as power and kind of is that really a thing or is it not a thing? And just all those complexities there. And, mm-hmm. You know, I feel like it's still very, it is a tricky argument that I still don't have a definitive answer on. So I did not know that about, I remember we have talked about some of the things in Egypt, but I could understand how that made you feel like, ugh, gross.
Yeah. And then, so Ireland keeps scoring and it gets to a point where Crumb catches the snitch, knowing full well that they're going to lose by him stopping the game at that particular point. Because again, catching the snitch does not automatically mean a win. It just means 150 points. So if the other team is ahead, like the Irish were, then it's over. And, you know,
this seems like a bit kind of like an ego-based decision on Crumb's part. Like he wanted to just prove that he could get it. Now, and I also know it fulfills the bet that the Weasley brothers made, you know, they kind of called it early on. So maybe they have some of that, you know, seeing that trolley.
Yeah, I think you have possibly have a point. Like, I think Crumb realized that the Irish Chasers, number one, they were too good. They were not going to get ahead, already accepting that the Irish were going to win. And he's like, okay, well, even though we can't win, at least people can like say I performed well. So even if I can't get the win for my team, I can at least get a semi win for me.
Right. Yeah. That's, I guess, and that kind of falls into the, like, we know that this is a player that everybody thinks is great. And he just kind of wanted to make sure that people remember that. I don't know what I've been watching something, reading something, I don't remember, that kind of falls into that context. And it's like,
because I haven't analyzed or thought about, you know, the specific positions in Quidditch and in terms of, you know, the fact that the Irish Chasers are so good, but it seems their Seeker like rammed into the ground twice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little brutal here in the previous, like the whole match. And then the kind of the complexity that the mascots bring, I thought was interesting too. Mm-hmm. Because they're more involved in the game than just like a picture that's kind of people wear to show support. So it was interesting.
And that, and the all the Irish and Bulgarian team members, they go through the top box, so they do get a close look at them.
Pretty cool for the everybody up there.
Yep.
And they get the cup up there too, right? They get that mm-hmm. handed off up there.
Mm-hmm. They'll be talking about this one for years, he said hoarsely. A really unexpected twist that shame it couldn't have lasted longer. Ah, yes, I owe you. How much? For Fred and George had just scrambled over the backs of their seats and were standing in front of Bluto and Bagman with broad grins on their faces, their hands outstretched.
Of course. Good on them. Good call for them.
Yep. And thus ends chapter 8. Alrighty then. So, are you ready for Gothic Geek Out?
Yes, I will try my best.
Yeah, again, the natural problem when the fact that we are not back at Hogwarts yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, and I would rather this be your Gothic thing. The closest thing I was thinking of was the Vila and kind of like equating them to a Gothic monster, but I felt like that was a bit of a stretch. So when you were talking about Orientalism, I feel like that would be a very good Gothic theme because that does appear in Gothic literature. Constantly.
Yeah, because, you know, we do get a few, like, black characters. We get a Asian descent character. But in terms of any sort of, you know, we don't get any Arabs, I don't think, in terms of being a sort of secondary character.
Okay.
So, yeah, so these few bits are like, these are the most Arabs I've seen in Harry Potter in a while.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that's interesting. I really struggled with this because I think that's just been a continuing theme thus far in this book is the gothicness is because we're not at Hogwarts yet. It's just kind of pulling. I'm basically pulling words as gothic words at this point.
Yeah. My only gothic theme was, of course, the Malfoys, because the Malfoys emulate that sort of old school family, and the Malfoys are very patriarchal. In fact, again, Narcissa doesn't even have a line.
Yeah, right. Oh, that's a good point.
And again, just they think there's so much. They just live in this like crazy bubble where they almost seem as though they're like, they should be from the 19th century, but it's like the 1990s.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking about the film depictions of them. They do very much kind of have a Victorian presence or something. In there.
Yeah. Aesthetic. Which again kind of makes sense because we already had several discussions about it seems that social mores and technology or like the magical equivalent of technological advancement is much slower to progress in the wizarding world than its muggle counterpart. So yeah, that's all I had, the Malfoys.
Me too. I mean, yeah.
Okay. So let us move on to the tarot of the day. The one I picked at random was the Page of Pentacles.
Mm-hmm.
A really good one because pentacles, of course, means
earthly delights, money.
And usually. Money.
Yes.
So, Page of Pentacles, upright manifestation, financial opportunity, skill development. Let's see. Page of Pentacles, like the pages of all four tarot suits, brings a welcome message of new beginnings, inspiration, and the initial stages of a creative project or venture. Since pentacles rule the material realm and correspond to the element of earth, this page symbolizes a beginning awareness of the value of money, wealth, possessions, career, and physical health, and how to manifest more of these material blessings. You welcome new opportunities to your material life, a new job, new business, or financial windfall, and wish to discover how to turn your dreams into reality.
I'm hoping that applies to us in real life more than it does in Harry Potter, to be quite honest. I was just thinking of particularly the box that the Weasleys and Harry and Hermione and everybody are sitting in. I don't particularly think about it as the beginning of a new project. I guess maybe from the win in Ireland, that probably gives them some sort of like clout and pride, you know, national pride. I know I've seen that in my own city. When a sports team wins, it just kind of elevates the morale of the city. So that could be and then the gambling, I guess it was a good call for Fred and George. So
I thought about obviously Fred and George winning their bet, getting, because they like, according to Arthur, basically bet all of their savings and it paid off. Which, yeah, not to condone gambling, but the only game I'm good at gambling at is roulette. I don't know why, but I just went into a casino and I tripled the money I left. Because I don't know, it was just really good that day.
I cannot think of a thing I'm good at gambling at. So, mm-hmm.
Yep. Although I bumped into this one, oh my God, down the rabbit hole of casino stories. So before I was doing the roulette, I tried blackjack, but then I realized very quickly, and there were, you know how it's kind of situated in a casino where there are other people playing blackjack alongside you?
Yeah.
And, you know, I very quickly realized that I did not remember how the rules work. And I'm like, okay, that's not. So I stepped out. And then like several hours later, like after I had fun at the slot machines, after I was doing my roulette stuff, we're congregated, my friend and I, by the blackjack tables. And this one woman who I guess was there before was bitching at me. It's like, you ruined my like winning streak or something. And I'm just like, I beg your pardon. And he's like, some of us have to pay bills. And I'm like, why are you at a casino to pay your bills? What? And it got to a point where clearly she was drunk. Clearly she was, frankly looked quite haggard, looked like a drug user. And it got to a point where my friend and I just started speaking in Arabic to like, you know, be condescending to her, because I'm like, this is stupid, like what the hell,
people are so weird. Like, it's not, either way, it's not your fault because you left a blackjack table, unless she was like, oh, this lady is such good luck, or I don't know, that's weird.
Yeah, so
people are weird.
Yeah, gambling. And then it just literally in description of the that I read, the financial windfall, the leprechauns, all the money falling to the earth.
Yes. I'd be out there with my like pot or whatever trying to get some of those gold. That's a pretty cool mascot to have, I gotta say. One that'll make the crowd rich or have some money.
Anything else in regards to Page of Pentacles?
No, I think I covered it the best I could.
So the rune of the day is Uruz, which means, it literally means Uruks. Like that was a specific type of like wild, like ox, I think.
Oh, okay.
So it tends to like mean like determination, persistence, freedom, courage, will, territoriality, independence. Let's see. Like Uruz is a symbol of the wild bovine, a reminder that cattle were once wild creatures. If Fefru, like that's the rune that represents like the domesticated like cow. If Fefru represents young lovers, Uruz represents young warriors. Though Uruz energy is also heavily invested in the Hamingjka, it is not suited for easy conscious control as Fehu is. It is the rune of powerful unconscious shaping energies that need to be guided wisely as they manifest. It is an early reminder within the series that the untamed powers of creativity are not without danger, a reality quite clear in our modern technological civilization. It is the user's skill and practice techniques that will control the energy unleashed by this rune. It is the rune of independence, asserting oneself and one's territory. So what I first think of is just the lack of predictability with gambling.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Because that can be a powerful force to the point that, again, a lot of times gambling is considered and can be an addiction.
Right, right.
That can just get completely out of control. And, you know, a lot of people have tried to make video gaming, like, classified as an addiction. And even people who advocate for that, like, it's not really like a substance abuse addiction. Like, it's a social, like, it's like the best you could compare the video game addiction would be gambling. Like, that sort of compulsive social behavior.
Interesting. I was, you know, if we're talking about gambling specifically, and I kind of mentioned this earlier with the Weasleys, with Arthur Weasley, that kind of, I just thought it was kind of low to like ask him to gamble on the game. But, you know, I guess people can do whatever they want to do. So the things that I took away from that were the idea of the warrior, like a young warrior. And I don't know, I know that a lot of times people, when they talk about sports, like to kind of compare themselves to like warriors. And I kind of thought probably in the young guy's eyes, Victor Krum was like the warrior of the Quidditch. You know, he's like kind of presenting himself in my mind as this, you know, badass who's finishing the game, just like bleeding everywhere, but still getting the snitch, and how like,
yeah, well,
somebody might equate
that. I'm sure there are more than a few like PhD dissertations about like the notion of sports, like replacing our violent need for war.
Yes. Yeah. I could talk about that for a while. So yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, in terms of the wild cow, like wild ox containing all sorts of energy. I don't know. In terms of unbridled, it was talking about unbridled like creativity that could possibly have problems. That kind of made me think of, like, again, with Victor Crumb, the sort of double-edged sword of being in that sort of profession, whether it's like, again, being a professional athlete or like being an actress, like doing something like a sport or an art at a very high level. And it, on the one hand, it must be great to be able to do that sort of art as a living, but also the toxicity of some of those industries.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. Now I'm thinking of the Quidditch players in a whole different world. Because that's the other thing with Crumb being like, he's supposed to be 18, I think, maybe. Mm-hmm. They don't really know, but he's pretty young to be a Quidditch player. So interesting what kind of exposure he has. I don't know. As I get older and as I watch football players like realize that they're like in their early 20s and I'm in my late 30s, I'm like, oh my God. I think about everything that they're exposed to at that age in being young and the kind of lack of exposure to the world that some of those guys have and how detrimental that can be for them. So.
Mm-hmm. All right, then. Anything else? The only thing I just think of, like, the wild, like, animal, like, young warrior, of course, you know, Victor Crumb emulates that because they compared him to as a huge bird of prey, and, like, Ron hero worships him, and as we know, Hermione will eventually have a certain connection with him, so it's just...
That, I was, like, wondering if anybody's mascot is, like, an ox. That'd be kind of a boring mascot. When we got leprechauns and Vahila. So. Yeah.
The unbridled wildness. The Vila turning into harpies.
Yeah. There we go. Unbridled wildness, I guess. That can...
Yeah. And now we move on to our final exercise. Fan fiction time.
Oof. Again, I think that I like to root my fan fiction in kind of the gothic or the kind of more Hogwartsy things, or killing off Hermione, I guess. So what if Hermione died? No, I'm kidding. The only thing I thought, you know, kind of very kind of simple is I really kind of assumed Mr. Roberts was an aware muggle, mm-hmm. like somebody who kind of knew that this was all stuff and was just kind of fine with it. They trusted him. That's not the case. But what if he were? How would that be different?
Well, what I'm thinking of, that now you've opened the can of worms, I'm thinking there's a committee of magically aware muggles.
Okay.
There should be a committee of magically aware muggles, there are enough muggles like Dursleys who like have a relative or, you know, have some connection where it would make sense that they would know, like they should, if they want to keep it secret, they should just create a committee or organization or consortium of those muggles to be able to call upon. And they should have like a list. Okay, here's a guy we know in like this department in the muggle government and this and that. Like that would make life so much easier.
It would make things easier, and the little, you know, we wouldn't have to be going around charming everything, and so muggles wouldn't be aware. So that's...
Yes, but that would require a certain level of trust in muggles and cooperation that the whole series is based on. There's a huge prejudice that we are better than muggles.
Right. So that trust isn't even there, because why would you
trust somebody less? The trust isn't even there, and it's the sense of, I think it's also a sort of ego thing where they don't want to rely on muggles who are aware to get shit done. They want to, at a certain level, want to show that we can keep our secrecy completely without the assistance of, you know, muggles who are aware of the situation.
Interesting. That was I think that one was kind of, you know, loose. The only other thing I thought was, what if Ireland lost and the repercussions that would have on the Weasleys? So.
Yeah. What if Bulgaria were to win? That is mine. because, again, I don't know. Again, I have so little experience in real life about, like, being invested in sports or, like, you know, people being really upset if their team lost. Because, again, this would be the home team, Ireland. They're in, you know, they're in Ireland or England, somewhere in the UK. And the visiting team, Bulgaria, won. You know, what does that imply for Quidditch in general? What does that imply for Victor Krum? Like, we don't know the careers of these particular players, and therefore we don't know what exactly was riding on this World Cup in terms of their right. career, their further advancement in the sport.
Yeah, you know, I think that, and having lived in a city where certain sports are very important, that's part of the reason I feel so awkward in my city, is a lot of people are just obsessed with sports that I see. Like, I remember when our team, or the Kansas City Chiefs, won the Super Bowl, how it boosted the city's morale. Interesting fact that the COVID-19 pandemic, I think they thought may have been spread a little more quickly if the opposite team, being San Francisco, would have won, because in Kansas City, like, the crowd size, you know, just whatever, because there was a parade and whatever. And it was freezing that day. But anyway, just thinking about, like, and then the next year they were in the Super Bowl and they lost. And to see people were very upset by that. Like, it's just interesting. And I'm not super invested either way. The only way I'm invested is that I want people to be happy. But it makes me think of, I believe in England, during certain football matches, they'll advertise about women helpline to call, because some people are so invested in that sport that they'll, or whatever sport, they'll, like, take it out on their spouse if the team loses.
That's so fucked up.
It is. It's very fucked up.
Yeah. No, that, I thought you were going to say that, like, win or lose, like, men go crazy and, like, rape women or something like that. Because there's literally, you know, the Indy 500 with the car mm-hmm. racing, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So there's the, in Bloomington, or I don't know exactly where, it's called the Little Indy 500, which mm. is with bicycles. Mm. It's a really bad situation where, like, every year a few women get raped. Like, because people go insane.
Oh, my God. That's... Hey, get your shit together, because this is ridiculous. There's no need. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a really bummer note.
Yeah. Well, to put it, I'm just thinking, because whether that, even that when the Irish won, like, it would have been interesting to see if, as an extra perk, that Ludo would have let the kids interact more with the winning team players and, like, you know, had asked some questions and maybe just have a dinner with them, like, maybe something like that. That would have been nice. So that didn't happen with the Irish either. But if the Bulgarians won and that happened, what if Hermione and Krum interacted sooner?
Hey, how that would have come? Yeah, because I know that, again, with my, like, piecemeal knowledge of these things, I know that that's going to happen. I don't know what happens after, how it gets there, but I know that it happens. So,
and thus concludes chapters 7 and 8 of Goblet of Fire. Tune in next time, everyone, as we cover chapters 9 and 10. The Dark Mark and Mayhem at the Ministry. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Rambling Raven Puffs. Our theme music was composed by John Williams, recreated by Kinez Norwar. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophie Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophie Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophie Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophieMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophie Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/Sophie Mare Studios, all lowercase. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks. That was the Sophie Mare Studios podcast.